All right, so the man behind the overpopulation myth has died, but the media keeps repeating his debunked claims. Let's talk this week about how the media and experts have been getting health and human flourishing wrong for more than 50 years. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu-Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. Catherine, I want to start with you because what we're going to talk about this week is Paul Ehrlich. Paul Ehrlich is the author of the 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb. The fundamental argument there was about the dangers of overpopulation. It was going to be an environmental catastrophe. And I kind of think that there is a case to be made that Paul Ehrlich is history's wrongest man. And yes, I have listened to podcasts, including this one, right? But like, think about his fundamental thesis, right? As the population was going to grow, the world would be poorer. That was the main, that was the core of his idea. More people, a poorer world. People would starve. We'd have resource scarcity. And we now have 60 years of evidence, 60 years of non-scaredages proving that wrong. And then, of course, there was the famous bet with Julian Simon, which we could talk about too.
Yeah. I mean, he just sucked so bad. And I'm sorry that he's dead because, unlike Paul Ehrlich, I like a planet full of people. I think all people are valuable. And I include, even grudgingly, Paul Ehrlich in that.
Sadly, he is not around to argue with us anymore. Nick, actually, I want to play a clip from Paul Ehrlich, something he said on television in 1970 that I think is representative of how he understood the implications of his views.
If that doesn't work, then you'll have the government legislating the size of the family. And people say, oh, that's impossible. Government can never intrude and tell you how many children to have. Well, I got news. You know, it intruded a long time ago and told you how many wives you can have. And there's not the slightest question that if we don't get the population under control with voluntary means, that in the not too distant future, the government will simply tell you how many children you can have and throw you in jail if you have too many.
Okay, so in that clip, he's basically calling for government action to stop people from having kids. And before we get to that point, he talks about how the FCC should, this is a quote, see to it that large families are always treated in a negative light on television, right? He wanted a kind of cultural fatwa against having kids.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
And, if he had gotten his way, and you know, we wouldn't have had eight is enough. So that's, you got to give him credit for that.
Yeah.
Right. But I mean, one of the things that I don't think
that's an FCC problem. I think that's an audience problem.
2026, yeah, everything is an FCC problem.
Yeah, that's true. And it's, and let's be fair, it's a Dick Van Patten problem.
Yes. Thank you.
Eight is enough as much as anything else. But one of the things that I think Ehrlich, particularly when he became famous in the late 60s through a good chunk of the 70s, the quickness with which he went from saying, okay, here's the science, and you know, he was wrong, Ron Bailey at Reason always, he introduced to me, and I think to many people, the term neo-Malthusian, because that's what Ehrlich was. He believed that population grew geometrically while food supply grew arithmetically, which was Thomas Malthus' big mistake in the 19th century. But the speed with which Ehrlich would go from supposedly diagnosing a fact of nature and then being like, and you know what, we really should be getting the government in, you know, ruling with this stuff. At various points, Ehrlich supported China's one-child policy and things like that. And in that interview, you know, the longer clip of it, it's amazing the speed with which he goes from this is happening, and if people don't stop having so many kids, the government should nudge them, and then finally, the you know, the government should force them into a particular.
And part of what's
position.
Also amazing is that he starts that clip by saying, you know, I don't favor government intervention into people's lives. And within 2 minutes and 5 seconds, he's saying, you know what? The government is going to have to intervene in people's lives.
There was this, growing up in the 70s, like Nick and I did, like this was everywhere. You just, the font on the cover of the Population Bomb. So you have this sort of, and like it was ambiently Population Bomb on one hand, and then like Me and the Oregon on the other hand. And I just always self-identified as a Me and the Oregon type.
It's the Orgone. Listen, Matt, maybe that's what your first misunderstanding, like, of Reichian therapy and Orson Bean.
I believe that my freedom is also pronunciatory freedom. That is
yeah, fair enough.
No, there's this howling pessimism.
The scarity.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's also true if you are into orgone energy. I mean, the population is going to explode. Exactly. Something's going to explode.
There is a tension there, a natural tension.
Yes, very much a tension. Phrasing.
Can we talk about the absolutely terrible New York Times obituary of Paul Ehrlich?
Yeah, actually, I want to ask you about that, Catherine, because you worked at the New York Times.
So, oh, come on. I can't be blamed for this and the war in Iraq.
You're going to get both.
Professional walk of shame. I mean,
just so everybody knows,
she worked at New York Times.
Yeah. Right. So the New York Times, the subhead on his obit reads, his best-selling 1968 book, which forecast global famines, made him a leader of the environmental movement. But he faced criticism when his predictions proved premature. Mm-hmm. Premature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Speaking of orgone energy.
Okay. Now we're back to orgone energy, yes.
Oh, I hate you all so much. Okay, so here's the thing. I will give the New York Times credit for the fact that they mentioned the famous Ehrlich-Julian Simon bet, which was a foundational text for me as a libertarian, I think for a lot of us. This is a bet where Julian Simon, frustrated with Paul Ehrlich's various shenanigans, finally said, like, put your money where your mouth is. And bet on the sort of prices and by proxy, the scarcity of five different sort of key components to industrial production and sort of metals, that kind of thing, and in the future. So this is Julian Simon wins the bet. And
the prices went down, which is what Julian Simon predicted. He was like, we're not going to have too little, and prices are going to go down. This was about scarcity.
Right. So the settlement of the bet ends up only being like $500, right? Because that they just agreed that they would pay the difference. But
which also was worth a lot less by the time the bet was settled.
Sure. But it absolutely proved the point that that there was this incredible resource, which was human ingenuity. Humanity is the humans are the ultimate resource, was Julian Simon's claim. Whereas Ehrlich, of course, thought that humans were the problem. But the lead of the Times piece actually says what you said in the subhead even more ridiculously. Paul Ehrlich, an eminent ecologist and population scientist whose best-selling book, The Population Bomb, was celebrated as a prescient warning of the coming age of food shortages and famine, but later criticized by conservatives and academic rivals for what they called its sky is falling rhetoric, died on Friday.
What?
Pounced? Yeah, conservatives pounced. So it is celebrated ambiently. Everyone celebrated it. And then conservatives and academic rivals questioned it. Never mind that, as one person tweeted, I think really outstandingly, Paul Ehrlich has died. He was 93. He is survived by 8,300,678,394 people and a daily worldwide calorie intake of 2,800 kilocalories.
All of whom are healthier.
Paul Ehrlich was wrong.
And
he was just
on average. Yeah, he wasn't prematurely correct.
And
he
also
was just incorrect.
I think it's always worth keeping, and not just to dunk on a single person, but there's always a market for environmental and other types of apocalypticism. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that can come from the right as well. And the amount of really bad policy that has flowed from that, it has just done incalculable damage. I think there's probably some kind of genetic, reward for people who are always saying that the sky is falling because we kind of want to believe that. And the person who warned about the saber-toothed tiger tended to live more than the person who didn't. But what we get from the population bomb style of looking at it, that's kind of the same thing that got us to ban nuclear energy, which turns out to be mm-hmm. probably the cleanest type of energy, but we were just filled with in the late 70s when orgone wasn't working.
Yeah.
It's orgone, come on. Then you would have, oh my God, the sky is falling. We're going to have Three Mile Island. We're going to have the China syndrome. We need to ban nukes, no nukes, Jackson Brown, etc. Mm-hmm. And that has been a catastrophic failure and has also contributed to the warming of the climate because the other options aren't so great. It's always with us. So we should always be protecting ourselves from yielding to the temptation of that kind of erroneous apocalypticism.
You know, if we have any, you know, if we're having this discussion now, though, it does seem to me that Ehrlich never, you know, he grudgingly paid Julian Simon, and I think he left the memo of the check like blank or wrote like you're a dick or something. And
no, his wife his wife signed it.
Yeah,
he didn't.
Oh, great. Okay. So even better. Well, you know, women tend to, you know, do the household expenses in the household, Matt. So it's like, although Anne Ehrlich is also a well-regarded scientist of her own. But, you know, what we're in now is the panic is over depopulation. And it's, you know, fascinating to me that we go from Ehrlich saying, you know what, the government really has to start turning the screws on people who are having too many kids or more than two kids. And now we've gotten to the flip side of that, where it's like every crazy conservative is like, you know what, we need $30,000, you know, for every kid, et cetera. And like, you know, Trump accounts and things like that. And even people who are arch critics of Paul Ehrlich, and I'm thinking of, you know, Marion Tupe and Gail Pooley, who wrote Superabundance. Marion runs Human Progress at the Cato Institute. They absolutely are committed to the idea that if you have a falling global population over time, economic performance and productivity will go down and living standards will decline. So it's kind of fascinating that, you know, we either have too many people or too few people, but we're never happy with the people that are actually right here, even on this very podcast.
Even.
Well, I mean, a falling population is straightforwardly a policy problem, particularly entitlement state. No, for the entitlement state. The entitlement.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a problem for the entitlement state. It's not a problem for me or
that's
you.
That's why it's a policy problem. Yeah. And that's what I mean, is that for existing policy, which was built on this sort of Ponzi scheme idea of an ever expanding population, they didn't think that population growth could slow or could fall. They built entitlements that assumed that there would always be a next generation to pay into the system.
And Nick, you've always suggested that when cities and states start to lose population, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Haven't you?
No. It varies.
What?
It varies.
Well, I'm sorry, what? Catherine, can we get a fact check in real time whether that is something that Nick has said on this podcast?
No, I think let him give
the subtle version.
Yeah. No, it's a problem for California if people are leaving, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. People live in states like Kansas or Wyoming that have had virtually no population growth or slight declines, and it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Okay.
I mean, me, I like people. I want to have as many people as we can, but I want to have as many people as we can without forcing people to act outside of their own preferences. And this is the thing I think, you know, Ehrlich starts always. He does actually always, if you see over his long, long career, he will always say this thing at the beginning, like, I'm not trying to force people to do anything. And then he is trying to force people to do things. And I just think that this deep confusion between what are my personal preferences, what does my analysis suggest about what would be best for humanity, and then what is the role of the state? And those are just separate questions. Those are two different questions. And we are here both from the, you know, population decline that needs to be remedied and from the population bomb that needs to be remedied perspective, conflating that every time.
Matt, earlier Nick was talking about the kind of laundering of, or maybe it was you, he was talking about the laundering of science to policy, of bad science to bad policy, from people who say in some cases, well, look, we're just trying to look out for people. We just want to do what's best for people. We're not trying to be authoritarians. Are there echoes of COVID, or did COVID echo Ehrlich and the population bomb? Is there a through line there from the kind of, this is what the science says, therefore we must, to this is what the science says, therefore we must, that we heard all the time during COVID?
I remember maybe 20 years ago, Nick will correct me, that Jacob Sullum had a cover story, and I think featured a real, real fat butt in some jeans. I'm getting that wrong, but saying the totalitarian implications of public health, I think, was more or less
that is there is a Jacob Sullum cover story with a big fat butt, but you are thinking of quite possibly the worst cover in recent history, and I'm responsible for all of them.
The French fries cover?
No, that I liked, and that was free. That was like stock photographs. No, it's There is the one about the totalitarian implications of public health. It's a stock photo of a finger pointing at the reader.
Oh God, oh. Yes.
Well, you know, it is so bad.
I thought it was the one that depicts a bunch of French fries
pointing back at you.
Yeah,
French fries.
Now the
French fries with little devil horns on them.
And, yeah, and sneers. Now these are three different stories. They may all be by Jacob. I'm not sure about the French fries one, but anyways, but it's the finger.
When I first read that story, as someone who's been very interested in totalitarian and post-totalitarian countries, I was like, I don't know, man. That seems a little hyperbolic to me. Over the years, I've come more towards, especially during COVID, towards Jacob's point of view. I might use the word authoritarian. This whole concept of that the government knows what's best for you. And to the extent that it's okay to lie to you, because that will produce the results and change your behavior in the way that the government knows is more healthy for you. So many people will accept that. And it's just terrible. During COVID, it was unbearable. I actually, when you even ask a question like that, I can feel the blood pressure going into a danger zone that my cardiologist would not like. It is. Like
Kenny Loggins would say, eject, Matt, bail out.
Bail out. Yeah. No, it's the root of some of the worst kind of policies and just tendencies. It really understandably turns people furious at a government that will lie to them for what they think is a way that they paternalistically know better than you about what to do with your life.
But I don't think Ehrlich was never, I don't think he was ever hiding the ball. You know, I mean, just to kind of keep these things clear, somebody like Anthony Fauci admitted that he was telling a bunch of noble lies. You know, he is Dr. Zayas in Planet of the Apes. Paul Ehrlich never admitted he was wrong. It wasn't like he was trying to fake anybody out. He was in earnest, just totally impenetrable to facts that contravened his theory.
Yeah, I mean, responsive to the question.
Yeah.
That's a different thing that is a problem here, and that is a different part of the problem, is that he is part of a class of people who were not prematurely correct, but were incorrect, were flat wrong forever. His predictions consistently proved wrong. When he made bets, he lost them every single time. Maybe not literally every single time, but so often when he made the kind of prediction that you could verify, it turned out that he was wrong. And he is now celebrated as, you know, prematurely correct. He never corrected himself. There was no accountability for this. And that is so common in elite public health advice in particular, as well as kind of the way the media treats this stuff. And everyone's always looking for an apocalypse, and everyone is always looking for a reason to tell everybody what to do. And so with that, I'm going to tell all of you what to do, which is take a break for a second while we go to a commercial.
It's tax season again, and charitable donors all over are digging through emails, receipts, and bank statements, and they're trying to reconstruct a year's worth of charitable giving. The good news is there is a better way. Donors Trust is the donor-advised fund provider for libertarians. Our friends at Donors Trust can help you simplify your giving, maximize your tax advantages, and support the causes you believe in, all from one account. You can contribute cash, stock, or other assets, and you'll receive a single receipt for your tax deduction each year. You can recommend grants to your favorite organizations on your own schedule, so no more December 31st rush, no more tax season scramble. Plus, the experts at Donors Trust can advise you on the most effective giving strategies. Their team shares your limited government views and will ensure that your giving remains faithful to your convictions. To learn more, download 6 key reasons to use a donor-advised fund. Just go to donorstrust.org/reason. That's donorstrust.org/reason. This will make your next tax season so much less painful.
All right. Speaking of bombs and authoritarians and the FCC, let's talk about the war in Iran. And Brendan Carr, the head of the Federal Communications Commission, who this weekend quoted a Trump social media post in which Trump complained about how the fake news is covering the war. He's been really griping about all the media coverage of the war in Iran. And Carr quoted this and said, "Broadcasters that are running hoaxes and news distortions also known as the fake news, have a chance now to correct course before their license renewals come up. That sounds kind of like a threat to take away their broadcast license if they do speech that Donald Trump doesn't like, doesn't it, Matt?
Trump over the week. Yes, it does. It's a direct threat, and it's in contravention. That's a word to a first day White House executive order that I'll remind everybody again was called Restoring Freedom of Speech and Ending Federal Censorship, in which it said that government censorship of speech is intolerable in a free society, and serially criticized the previous administration for doing that. In fact, said under the guise of government combating misinformation, disinformation, and malinformation, the federal government infringed on the constitutionally protected speech rights of American citizens across the United States, because those places were saying things that were against the government narrative. Donald Trump literally over the weekend on Sunday, Truth Socialed that media outlets that cover the Iran war in ways he doesn't like should be brought up on charges for all caps treason for the dissemination of false information. So I will once again say, for those of the electorate who were excited about voting for Donald Trump because of free speech, congratulations, you got played.
So Brendan Carr is obviously pretty awful here, right? I mean, this is not free speech. This is not what the Trump administration promised. It's not what Donald Trump campaigned on. And yet the reporting on this, Nick, suggests that some of this is coming directly from Trump. Carr spent time with Trump in Mar-a-Lago just a few days before tweeting this. It's pretty clear that Trump, who is a creature of the media, who, I mean, by all accounts, just constantly watching Fox News, CNN, you know, reading all the major papers, right? And just like that's how he thinks of his presidency as, you know, as how it is covered in the media, right? He is a figure of the media. And so he sees Carr as his attack dog. And I don't want to say that we know that this was a direct order from Trump, but it does seem like it is culturally coming down the pipe from number one.
I mean, of course it is. And even if it isn't, I mean, Brendan Carr is clearly overstepping his bounds. First off, that's a given. Yes, he's doing the president's bidding, the guy who appointed him. And yes, both of them are wrong. And this, you know, if we need more reasons to abolish the FCC or at least take it out of any kind of content regulation role, I think we're, you know, they're putting on a clinic for us. This is a completely intolerable, and it is indefensible from any position other than I am Donald Trump's, you know, message boy.
You know who's doing a really good critique of this approach by the FCC is the remaining Democratic FCC commissioner, Ana Gomez, who is just fully out here counter-programming at this point. So she said, after Carr did the tweet, she said, "The FCC can issue threats all day long, but it is powerless to carry them out. Such threats violate the First Amendment and will go nowhere. Broadcasters should continue covering the news fiercely and independently without fear of government pressure." What weird times we are in, where an FCC commissioner is like out here very explicitly saying, please ignore the other FCC commissioners.
And let's remember that last time around, Trump was saying similar things back then. I don't know about the treason part, probably I'd forgotten, but certainly about threatening broadcast licenses. And his then FCC chair, Ajit Pai, said basically no. So this is a great illustration about one of the differences between the first Trump administration and the second. In the second Trump administration, the type of people that he nominates are people who aspire to be his mini-me's and try lamely to turn from a bureaucrat into somebody who does memes and has very authoritarian style ideas. And that is one of the reasons why the second Trump administration, in many ways, is considerably worse than the first.
All right. Speaking of Trump mini-me's, I wanted to talk about someone here, J.D. Vance, who is a sort of interesting character right now because of the war in Iran. And J.D. Vance has been an anti-hawk, not just a dove, but an anti-hawk in public life for many years now. And it is becoming known through reports in the media that are anonymously sourced to a pair of government officials, that J.D. Vance has some concerns about the war in Iran. Catherine, what do you make of what Vance is maybe doing here?
I mean, I don't like to agree with J.D. Vance, but I too have some concerns about the war in Iran. So here's the thing, right? Lots and lots and lots of people, including Brendan Carr, by the way, have just sort of done a 180 and turned away from previous statements that they've made of all kinds that disagree with Trump. And Vance has done that 100 times, 1,000,000 times to get where he is. But he has been historically especially clear about the fact that this type of engagement with Iran is not going to work out and that he is very, very skeptical of it. So I do think he kind of had no choice but to do something here where he's positioning himself, at least he's trying to be loyal opposition, right? And that's what these leaks suggest is like, he's just sharing another opinion. And Trump has said that. Trump has said, when asked about this, like, yeah, I let people have different opinions and we disagree, but he still backs this very strongly. That's what Trump keeps saying.
Do you think he's actually trying to be loyal opposition rather than establish himself as the kind of actually anti-war guy who might be a successor to Trump here? I mean, Trump has been talking about how he thinks his two potential successors are Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance. And Rubio is clearly a big hawk who is very much in favor of what's going on in Iran, or at least, you know, of military action in Iran, right? Sort of push for Venezuela, clearly, at least, one of the people pushing to do whatever it is Trump thinks we're going to do in Cuba. Is Vance actually being loyal opposition, or is he just trying to sort of save his own skin and position himself for the next election?
I mean, maybe I'm being naive, but I don't think every single thing ever always is electoral positioning. And I do think this is Vance's actual position. I think it is well documented that it is his actual position. And so I think this is much more around managing that apparent discrepancy than like being the un-Rubio. It could be both, but I just don't see. I don't know. Maybe I'm an idiot and everyone just wants to be president. And that's the only thing that's happening.
I think Trump has a political problem on his hands, which is that this war at the outset is about the least popular war at the beginning of a war that we have ever seen. If Syria would have happened, it would have been probably more unpopular, but it didn't fully happen back in 2013. So, and parts of his base, his electorate, are fracturing and squabbling. We saw over the weekend that Trump intruded over to some just unbelievably petty and acrimonious squabble between Mark Levin and Megyn Kelly. And he went...
is that micropenis Mark Levin is it a different... Is it the Dorchester Levins?
Got into the micropenis wars and he was in charge of the differently penised in this case, or he was on the size side of them, not the size. But part of that, I think, is all of those squabbles are a succession battle. I mean, one of the reasons why there's been this open kind of a war between various factions on the right in the last six to eight months is that people are seeing that electoral future and kind of weighing in, and they're elbowing one another. And that can be fine and well and good until you absolutely rely on all of those people to shore up support for an unpopular war. That's where Trump is right now. So he's trying to manage that. I would presume that he was fine with those leaks happening because, you know, you're going to want someone to blame or praise when this thing turns out differently than it was sold as at the beginning, to the extent it was sold at all.
The Vance spokesperson who responded to the leaks about Vance in Politico was offered this very funny sort of huffy, like, "you stupid media people" response that didn't actually say that it was wrong. It was like, you're the worst. And there's been all these leaks and, you know, the leaks, you can't trust leaks, but they didn't actually say Vance doesn't believe this. It was really funny.
The spokesman
I'm
also
so
said
sorry for the micropenis
just...
part of this.
No, it's inevitable. I also think in that spokesman thing, the spokesman said, everyone just sees what they want to see in J.D. Vance, which is not true. That's not true.
I was going to say, just
sorts, right? He's kind of political Odo.
Add a bit to this that, you know, Rubio and J.D. Vance are sizing each other up. They're within the administration. But if we're playing horse race politics for a little bit, the real big thing is anybody who is attached to the Trump administration is going to be, you know, more radioactive than Newt Gingrich quoted some guy who was like, you know, we could just drop a bunch of nukes and create a new Persian Gulf canal anytime that we want. But this, you know, the big winners in this kind of stuff are people like Ron DeSantis, because they're keeping their distance from this administration, which is just really going sideways in a big way.
Yeah, the Rubio Vance thing, definitely just a dick measuring contest. I'm so sorry.
I just wish they could see they're in love with each other.
Mm-hmm. All right, we got to take a break.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Well, it's March, and that includes International Women's Day. That's a moment to celebrate women's strength and progress while also recognizing how much women carry every day. The women in our lives care for us. But too often, that means their own emotional well-being, well, sometimes it gets ignored. So for International Women's Day, take a break. Reflect on the important women in your life, your mother, your sister, your partner, even a trusted friend. And think about the roles they play, the expectations they shoulder, the pressures they might feel. That's where therapy from BetterHelp comes in. Therapy can create balance, help set healthy boundaries, and support overall well-being for everyone. BetterHelp has quality therapists. They work according to a strict code of conduct. You start by filling out a short questionnaire about your goals, what you want from therapy. Then BetterHelp will match you with a therapist. If you're not happy, you can switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform. It serves over 6 million people globally, and it works. BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session, and that is based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Your emotional well-being matters. You can find support and feel lighter in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Once again, this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp.
Okay. As a reminder, we love to answer your questions so long as they are short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long. You can send your questions to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. Please put the words listener question in your subject line. That is what this week's listener did. Listener question did comes from Jody, who writes, I agree with all the criticism of DHS on a recent podcast. Wasn't DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, meant to be a central place for all the intel from different agencies? Is that a needed function? Catherine, I want to ask this to you because in addition to the New York Times, you worked at the Weekly Standard around the time of the Iraq War and also worked quite near to something called the Project for a New American Century, right? You worked like in Neocon Central. I think the American Enterprise Institute was also in that building.
Yes.
Indeed. And they were generally in favor of creating DHS. And one of the arguments was basically what Jody is saying, which is you got to have another agency to handle the interagency. And this was a word that people who wanted to sound smart said all the time, interagency, right? That's what DHS is for. It's a coordinating agency because there's too many agencies and they can't talk to each other. So we got to create another one that's just to make sure that they're all on the same page. How'd that work out?
I feel like your explanation is the answer to this question. Like, it is never the right answer to make another agency because the agencies aren't good at agencying together as agencies. Yeah. In fact, this has turned out 1,000% predictably, which is to say that there is now just another agency which still doesn't coordinate well and play well with others. There are just multiple centers of power and they are always at odds. My main memory of that time actually is the deep, deep unease that I felt and that many libertarians felt with the word homeland, which has now become, you know, you hardly even hear it when people say it because it's part of our basic political vocabulary. But it remains to me a kind of weird dog whistle-y word. You know, this wasn't just an office of coordination. This was a reframing of what all of these institutions were for. And a kind of shift in the idea of, you know, America as an idea or just even the government as a government agencies as places that do things to this like holistic homeland, protecting it perhaps not just in physical ways, but also, as it has turned out, in far more complicated kind of cultural ways.
And then it turned into a TV show, not just 24, but literally a television show called Homeland, starring, among other people, Mandy Patinkin. Of Inigo Montoya
fame. He's so good in everything,
He's got that great scraggly beard. And every single episode, just sort of like two-thirds of the way through, he's like, Attack on the Homeland.
Also originated the role of Che Guevara in Evita on The Great White Way, which Matt Welch still wants to act on.
Strangely. But he got his revenge against the six-fingered man.
Little known thing about Matt. Homeland Security should be abolished. I can pretty much, you know, I have a Mad Lib template, abolish the, and then a random three-letter generator, and it works pretty well. About 6 years ago or sometime, or 7 years ago in 2019, I published a video whose title was "It's Time to Abolish the DHS." It has not served the purpose that it was designed to fill, which was to allow for better and more efficient kind of information sharing. This was the big scar coming out of 9/11, was that if only the CIA and the FBI, you know, talked more about which Americans they were de-civil libertizing blocking Orgone Energy of. And it turned out like none of what DHS is doing, you know, is helping these agencies be more effective. As Catherine was pointing out, it just, you know, when you jack up the number of people who are reporting to somebody, you don't make information sharing easier. You make it more complicated and more sclerotic if possible. So it's time for DHS to take a hike.
Although, don't you miss the color-coded warnings?
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, let's not be crazy about it. Yeah.
We're orange.
It was always orange. It was orange 100% of the time.
Well, there were no orange. In front of elections, it would sometimes go up to red, right? Yeah. And then right after the election, it might cool down a little bit. We never got to that nice indigo.
I would.
It's like the color coding scheme for the weapons in World of Warcraft, right?
Yes.
Yes, it's just like that. I would like to.
That's what I was thinking.
Read the from the first piece ever that referenced the Department of Homeland Security on the Reason site. It's from 2002 from a cat we'll be talking about soon named Brian Doherty. Here's the lead. President Bush has announced his plan to ensure domestic security, creating a massive new bureaucracy. The proposed Department of Homeland Security would incorporate elements of many existing massive bureaucracies and oversee some of the other massive old bureaucracies, such as the CIA and FBI, that have failed dramatically at ensuring domestic security. I think that pretty much came out as Reason, and not just Brian, and not just on that exact line of critique. Critiqued it at the beginning. It has turned out to be a failure, albeit a predictable failure.
I think there are some conservatives who would say it worked, actually, because there was not another major terror attack after 9/11. And this, in fact, was a much more common argument up through Donald Trump's first campaign, in which Donald Trump's big breakout moment was when he was debating Jeb Bush. And Jeb Bush was talking about George W. Bush, his brother, the former president. And Jeb Bush said, "But he kept us safe." And he was about to say a bunch of other stuff. And then it was like he was on a podcast because Donald Trump was just like, "No, he didn't." Like Trump just like blurted out, "No, he didn't." Like what it was like, that's ridiculous. He did not keep us safe. 9/11 happened on his watch. And so it is really remarkable to me that we now have President Trump, who is abusing DHS, who's taking us to war in the Middle East. These are all the things that he ran against. He ran against government censorship of free speech. He ran against endless war. He ran against a giant state that can tell you what to do all the time. And that's what we have under him still. And it is it's frustrating, disappointing, maybe kind of predictable, but even when they run against it, you can't trust them. And here we are. In any case, let's move on to sad and somber news. Brian Doherty, who Matt Welch just read a quote from, senior editor at Reason, longtime member of the Reason family, my colleague for nearly 20 years, died unexpectedly last week at the age of 57. And I just want to take a moment on the pod here to remember him, because Brian was the soul of Reason. I think in so many ways, maybe not always the face, but he was a serious scholar and a journalist, right? He wrote Radicals for Capitalism, the definitive history of libertarian ideas and personalities. And he was also devoted to living his own excellent life in so many ways. And he wrote about comic books. He spent a huge amount of time in the kind of music and arts communities out in California. And he built a life that was outside of politics and that was outside his own. And it was cut short way too soon. I didn't know him nearly as well, I think, as the rest of you did. But it's very strange that he is gone. Matt, Nick, you guys wrote about him. What do you want to say?
I think Nick has one of the a top tier Brian Doherty story. I mean, read both of our pieces about him that I think summed up his work, but also, and this is true of his dear loved ones, some of whom I've talked with over the last couple of days, who are absolutely anguished and grieving, but they are sharing some hilarious Brian stories. Nick, do you want to share with class?
I mean, it's really hard because I am, you know, just I'm bereft. It's a heartless world. And, you know, Brian, in a way, if we're being ironic, in a way that I think you would want to be, you know, he died doing what he loved, which was
absolutely true.
You know, hanging out at a party, probably on drugs and accidentally falling to his death.
I don't know about the drugs, but.
Well, no, but the story I was going to tell, which I haven't had a place for, and this has like some minor reason lore behind it. This was years ago. At some point, we had an event out in the desert that Brian would eventually end up buying a house in, which he was kind of like, that was, you know, he could afford a house in the desert. And then he was like, God, this, you know, it's really hot out here. But he was given the charge of picking up Steve Forbes, who was speaking at this Reason event in the middle of the desert. And the way I think about it, it was like 1,000 degrees out there. It was dark, like 24 hours. But he picks up Steve Forbes from the airport at LAX in a rental car because he had bought a car from Jacob Sullum, a beat up old station wagon that he immediately started filling with like newspapers and other things. And so they were like, okay, Reason, now get, you know, rent a car to bring Steve Forbes out to the event. And he was joking to me beforehand that this was going to be his Melvin and Howard moment, where he would, you know, he would be driving with this, you know, rich, famous person through the desert and somehow charm him to get and end up being in Steve Forbes's will. Which is kind of the story of Melvin and Howard, which is about a fake story about Howard Hughes. And so, you know, they're driving. Steve Forbes was just like, you know, thanks for picking me up. And that was the only thing he said, like, the whole time. And Brian is like, you know, how do I crack this? And then he was driving Steve back after he spoke the same night. And he said, like, they stopped for gas and Steve still wouldn't talk to him. And then while Brian was getting gas, Steve Forbes bought like $40 worth of candy and just ate it all, ate it all himself in like one huge paroxysm of sugar consumption. And then like all the wrappers were just around the floor. And Brian was like, well, I guess I'm not getting in the will.
I think fairness to Steve Forbes, Nick, that he just somehow knew how Brian enjoys his cars, which was with a lot of
I'm sure those rappers, like, he probably picked them up and put him in his station wagon after that. But what I enjoyed ultimately about Brian and is that he obviously was insanely interested in politics and ideology and this kind of stuff, but really he knew and lived his life kind of like, oh, and it's the least important part of anyone's life. So he was doing stuff with people, most of whom he would freely acknowledge, like to the extent that they talked about politics, they disagreed wildly. He wrote This Is Burning Man, which was the kind of the first really serious reported and sociological look at Burning Man. And, you know, most of the people at Burning Man, there's a lot of actual libertarians, but most of the people are like, oh, you know, I'm really worried about global warming, except for the 2 weeks a year when we explode, you know, the equivalent of nuclear bombs, you know, with propane tanks out in the middle of the desert. But so it's sad. And I can't make any sense of it. And I think the only thing I know I can do, and I suspect we're all like this, is enjoy the time that we had with him.
Catherine, do you want to say anything?
Yeah, to me, Brian really also just puts paid to this idea that you can't be free and responsible. Like, so often I think you hear that, you're like, oh, libertarians, you guys are just, you know, smoking pot and all in a shambles. And Brian was the most chaotic person that I was close with. I think that's fair to say. Like the of the people that I have close regular contact with, Brian had maximal chaos in his life. Yeah. And I work at Reason. But I also relied on Brian to be the most scrupulous and conscientious person that I knew in so many ways. And I think people don't necessarily see that from the outside. But in addition to just being, I would say, pathologically concerned with getting the details of his reporting right, just reporting and re-reporting and confirming and checking and rechecking in ways that were above and beyond, even for Reason's high standards. He also was our proofreader. And I think people don't necessarily see Brian Doherty and think that's a guy who's going to get those commas in the right place, but he absolutely was. And in fact, even when he was unwell, even when he was distracted, he was genuinely troubled if he hadn't clapped eyes on every single page of the magazine to make sure that it was up to his high standards and our high standards. And I just think any time that you're tempted to say, look at these crazy people who want freedom, you know, chaos will result, like, yes, and order will result. And Brian was a bringer of order in a way that I'm going to miss personally, and also that I'm going to miss, like, in the meeting I have to go to after this podcast to figure out who's going to do all the stuff that Brian did for us every day.
I know that, Catherine, you've said that it kind of sucks now because you just lost your obituary writer. It starts with, like, who's going to write that obituary? But also, I'm worried that now that Brian's gone, I think I might be the biggest Luddite on staff. Like, that's, I can't fill his shoes with that, but I will aspire to. I will aspire to
be. Thank you. You might also be our obituary writer now, FYI. So we'll talk about that.
Yeah, I'm worried about that.
Well, it being. Yeah. Well,
I'm worried about it too, Matt.
Thank you.
All right, let's move on to our final segment. Cultural recommendations, what we have been watching and consuming in the cultural realm. Obviously, there was a big cultural event this weekend, the Oscars ceremony, the Academy Awards, and the big winner was One Battle After Another, Paul Thomas Anderson's story about an ex-radical bomber, part of a radical leftist group called the French 75, who, after going on the run, is tracked down by a sort of evil agent of the state played by Sean Penn, and he and his daughter sort of run through the Southwest California area, Texas, a little bit. It's sort of and through an immigrant sanctuary city, and sort of end up in a battle for their lives with a crazy racist sort of KKK like group called the Christmas Adventurers Club, and parts of the U.S. military. I was pretty critical of this movie when it came out. I have come around on it to some degree, just because sort of at a micro level, moment to moment, I think it works pretty well. And that, and just sort of stringing you along and being good in the moment and being well-crafted, it goes a long way in my book. I still think the movie has big macro thematic problems. Nick, what did you think of this? I think you said something in Slack, like it was a moral failure.
Yeah.
Morally confused.
Yeah, or stupid, actually. I think I said it was morally stupid. Because it is, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson's a great movie maker, but he is ultimately, and I, you know, on a technical level, you know, in the plot, it keeps you going, all that kind of stuff. It's a long movie, but you don't really feel that. But it is morally stupid. And what it reveals ultimately is that Paul Thomas Anderson is a nostalgia merchant. And that's good when you're looking at a movie like Licorice Pizza. And Matt, if you haven't seen that, you should. It's really your exact childhood, I believe, because it's a couple of years young for me. But it's great.
I didn't realize Matt was a waterbed salesman.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
You know, are you kidding? Matt was, I'm sure, conceived and will die on a waterbed. So
I'm sitting on one right now.
Matt grew up in a house with an unfinished conversation pit. So it's like, you know, he's, yeah.
Explains a lot.
But
it really does. That,
yeah, the unfinished conversation pit.
My memoir has a title. Thank you.
Kind of finish the point, this is a movie that, you know, presents a kind of cartoon glib version of revolutionary violence. And it justifies it by having, you know, Sean Penn, who is not only morally stupid, he is like, you know, mentally stupid. He's somebody who loves Hugo Chavez and like every authoritarian dictator not named Trump or Bush that he can find. But, you know, playing like a white, you know, a guy who is a white supremacist, but is, you know, riven with love for black women, who then gets taken advantage of by an even bigger conspiracy of actual, like, you know, heritage American white racists who run everything. It's a stupid movie that romances and apologizes for revolutionary violence. And it is, you know, it is meaningful that it was inspired by the work of Thomas Pynchon, and, you know, PTA has done an actual movie based on a Thomas Pynchon novel. Pynchon himself, who faded from American letters because he was not as deep a thinker as he seemed to be in the early 70s. You know, it's just fetishizing revolutionary violence when we know what happens in revolutions and we know what happens with violence, and it's not good thing and it's not liberating and it's not, you know, celebratory. It is just brutal thugs who take out their own psychoses through ideology on the people closest to them. And that is true of groups like the Weather Underground or the Symbionese Liberation Army that are kind of that form, you know, part of the text that is being played with here and made into a kind of friendly cartoon version while looking in the rearview mirror. So that's why it bothers me when movies like this do well and then just kind of get taken as like, oh, isn't that cool and fun? And oh, I wish I had been around in a time when the Weather Underground, which retconned its violent history, to talk about how, oh, we were just trying to save, you know, save America, or we were driven insane. And the only way we could respond to state violence in Vietnam was by, you know, blowing up our own people or other people who were completely innocent.
At the risk of extending our fourth conversation on this movie, on this podcast, I'll just say that I didn't read it that way at all. I thought it satirized those people, and it elevated, the ultimate message was elevating family over the types of revolutionary idiocy that breaks families.
I disagree.
I'm more open to that interpretation than I was when the movie came out, but I still find myself sort of pulled in both directions on this film. Catherine, what do you have for us?
Listen, I'm sorry for what I'm about to say. Here's what happened. What had happened was I've talked about this podcast before many times on our podcast, the 60 Songs That Explain the 90s podcast. The new season is 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, colon, the 2000s. And I was listening to an episode about Outkast's Miss Jackson, which extensively discussed Andre 3000's 2023 album, New Blue Sun. So I listened to that album. And you guys, it's a flute album. So
really?
I'm sorry, but the first track on it is called I Swear I Really Wanted to Make a Rap Album, But This Is Literally the Way the Wind Blew Me This Time. And it's flute. And then there are other tracks on it that are called Ants to You, comma, Gods to Who, question mark. And also my favorite track, That Night in Hawaii When I Turned Into a Panther and Started Making These Low Register Purring Tones That I Couldn't Control, Shit Was Wild.
That's great.
Wow. That's like a tweet.
That's what I have been consuming. And frankly, so what I suggest like that it? You all consume. I really liked it. And it feels to me like it has huge Brian Doherty energy. So this is the connection that I want to make. I am supposed to be doing one thing, but I have to creatively go do this other thing, and damn well I am going to do it. It feels very Brian to me. It resulted in a thing that shouldn't be good and is good. And so I recommend to you New Blue Sun, the flute album of Andre 3000. Yeah. I'm sorry, and you're welcome.
Is it just flute, or is it, you know?
It's kind of like, I think you would call it almost like new age. Like it's like ambient.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of dinging and clicking and weird percussion that sounds like maybe it's a shell or a somebody dropping something and then
blowing on a bottle, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And Matt will, because I think he lived this album, but there's a 1978 album from Dan Fogelberg and Tim Weisberg, who is a jazz flautist, called Twin Sons of Different Mothers, that if you suddenly now have a incredible urge to hear flute music, Catherine.
I will remind you that I'm on year like 40 of an incredible urge to hear flute music because I do play the flute.
No. And the association, like, you know, a pretty good band that played Monterey. I don't know where. I mean, they played a bunch of the big festivals. A lot of flute.
That's right.
I played flute for a little bit. No, I love this idea that Brian was our Andre 3000, right? Compulsive and inscrutable, and maybe not for everyone, but also but verbose, right?
More
you
notes.
Didn't always know. You didn't always know what this. There would be sets of words strung together. And you would be like, I can see that he believes these make sense. And you could feel, you could in fact feel that there was an internal logic to them. But what they meant?
We should take more time than we have allotted to remember him. But, we both wrote for Suck.com in the 90s. And one of the things that we talked about, and, he would say, when I sat down to write a Suck piece, and for the people who don't know, this was a site that began as a side project for two guys who worked at Wired, who were doing it on the clock, but they weren't supposed to be doing it. So everybody who wrote for it had nom de plumes. And he used Eugen von Baum-Bowerk, who's the founder of the Austrian school, which also, my piece I did there was making fun of Christopher Reeve for crippling himself. And Mr. Pitalik is the imp, the fifth dimension imp who like torments Superman in certain comic books. But Brian would say, and this was absolutely true, and all of us have written elsewhere, but like he would say, when I write for reason, I get kind of like clotted up. Like because I know I have to be serious, even if I'm trying to be comic. And when I would write for Suck, he would say, like it just flowed. And it was fascinating because his pieces and Suck, unfortunately, is offline. I will recommend that nobody actually Google suck.com at this point in human history. The archive is gone, but his work was both very funny and scabrous, and it read like a different person. And I totally get that because there was something about, when you're writing for reason, you want to be serious and deep and profound. And suddenly all of these weird clauses start, before you can even get to the clearing of the point you're trying to make, you've built up this, forest of, profundity.
It doesn't seem familiar in any way. Matt, what sort of goatee do you have for us?
So instead of watching any damn Oscar related content last night, I watched what might have been the greatest competitive game or the greatest level of talent playing a game that mattered in baseball history. It was the USA versus the Dominican Republic in the semifinals, winner take all World Baseball Classic. World Baseball Classic happens every 3 years. 20 teams show up and usually Japan wins. They got knocked out in the semis or the quarters this time quarters. And USA has won just one time. And the last two or three or so of these events, the USA started sending its really good players. And the Dominican Republic has, basically five Hall of Famers in their starting lineup. Just incredible, like in their peak. It's not that they're riding the back end of their career. So they played yesterday. Everyone was very excited about this. This is the semifinals. Whoever wins that game is likely going to win the finals, which will be either against Italy, surprisingly, basically a bunch of Italian-Americans, or Venezuelan who played tonight. But it was just a tremendous game. It was 2-1. It was nail-biting. There were catches of home run balls that would have gone over the fence. Just incredible, high-level, exciting baseball. And if you don't like World Baseball Classic level baseball, I don't think that it's possible to really like baseball at all. And Catherine, I'll just leave with you this. I think I mentioned this to you a recent weekend, but every team has a colorful and country, nationally appropriate celebration for hitting home runs and various things. The Italian team, which plays tonight, has probably the best, which is all these Johnny Bunch of Owls who play in Major League Baseball and don't have Italian passports, but are on the team. After they hit home runs, they come to the dugout and are fitted with an Armani jacket, given a shot of espresso, and then afterwards they get a kiss on two cheeks, which is just awesome. It's filled with all kinds of frivolity like that.
And if they lose, they'll get strung up by their heels like Mussolini, Matt.
This is one can only hope.
Yeah.
They're doing it for the homeland. All right, folks, that is our show for this week. If you like what we do and you want to support us, you can donate at reason.com/donate. Support the Reason Roundtable and everything we do. Reason.com/donate. The Reason Roundtable will return.